Well, here we are at the end of July, and it seems like we're getting all the rain this year that we didn't get last year. Wonder if, whether or not that's true, or does it just seem that way? We've always enjoyed our monthly visit from our weather guys, and here they are back. And really, today is even better than usual because they're with us for the whole 90 minutes today instead of just 45 minutes like they normally are. Figured we could put them to work more in the summer since they aren't teaching right now. And they have nothing else to do anyway. They might as well be here.
Yeah, it's summertime.
It is. Yeah, we just sit around and twiddle our thumbs all summer.
Oh, man. Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He's professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Great to have you back, Steve.
Great to be here.
And John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. And John, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Larry.
We have lots of things we can talk about. You may have some questions for these guys as we move along here today, and I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post a question and or photo, love to see a good weather photo, on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. So we'd love to hear from you one way or the other, or the other. there are three different ways to do it. You can call us at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and go from there. Here we are, the end of July.
Unbelievable. Doesn't feel like it, but,
yeah, but man,
end of October.
It seems like it's been a wet summer. Where are we really in terms of?
Yeah, we're 16 inches above normal through the end of July. I think the normal is about 19 and a half by this time of year, and we're at 36.
Wow,
it's so astounding. It's wet. Almost double.
Yeah,
the amount of normal precipitation.
For that's for the Madison area, or
yeah, that's for Madison Station itself. But it's probably
representative of
the region. Yeah,
yeah. So
it's weird to have this really cool October weather, but everything's green.
Yeah, we just got back from Seattle. It's what Seattle feels like on a regular day. They've been a little bit warmer than normal recently, but that's what it feels like: 70 degrees every day and green.
Wow,
yeah,
that's unbelievable.
Well,
but we have the sun too.
Yeah, right.
It's probably a good thing, or was it a good thing to have all this extra rain?
I think it's been a good thing. A lot of parts of the state were in really desperate drought conditions. We were a year ago right now. We were in what category?
Yeah, that's right.
Like category 4 extreme drought or something?
Yep.
And now it's gone away, which is great news for the economy of a state like ours.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just looking at the drought monitor this morning, and this is the first time I remember in a long time where something isn't covered in Wisconsin in drought. So
yeah, I didn't look.
Everything's cleared up.
Right. It seems like it's been almost every single year for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
so
interesting.
There were so many lakes in northern Wisconsin that were, I mean, some even
down,
right
yeah.
up.
Yeah.
Way, way down. So I've got to believe that this extra water.
I think it's good.
Yeah. Great Lakes is still down.
Yeah.
By almost a foot, I think.
Are they?
Yeah, they're still. Michigan is anyway. Superior, too.
And you drop it a foot.
That's a lot.
You look at the shoreline.
And they've been that way for a long time, since 99. Yeah. They've been down.
Well, what about tornado activity? I can't recall much in the way of tornado activity in Wisconsin.
Not in the state. We just haven't had that kind of summer thus far. I mean, we should be careful saying that because the summer is far from over, even though it feels like, you know, it's the opening of the Big Ten season outside, but that's not the case.
Yeah.
We still have
August.
Yeah. So, that's true. It's been a below normal tornado season, not just for the upper Midwest. I think that's true across the country. We had that one real
couple
big
of really
spurt,
big,
and that was it this year. After the year before, which was a record year.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing.
That's a very good thing, I think, for a lot of property owners,
One of your colleagues, Steve, Liam Gumley?
Liam Gumley, yeah. Yep.
He's created a smartphone app.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you talk? Give us the background on that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so Madison, Wisconsin, has been called the mecca of satellite meteorology in the sense that if you do satellites and weather, that you got to come and visit the UW campus at some point in your career. And this is just another example of that, where you know, a group of people, Liam was involved, Parker, Dave Parker, Bruce and Bob, and it was several people talking about, wouldn't it be nice to get satellite data right in the hands of people's phones? Mm-hmm. And so they developed an app where when the satellites come over, they, and these are for polar orbiters, because it's actually, we're using it for validation of some of our satellite products, drive products. So when it gives you a 5-minute or a 10-minute or a 2-minute, you get to pick the option, warning that the satellite's going to be over your head. And then you go outside with your smartphone and take a picture of the sky, categorize the sky cover like the National Weather Service people do, then take a picture of the surroundings and classify that, whether it's an urban area, desert, water, or whatever. And then in about a half an hour or so, when the data has been processed, you'll get a picture of what that That's area awesome. Looked like from the satellite perspective, in a, as if it was a photo type thing. So it's really fascinating
that's a good idea.
To see the area. I mean, whenever I go someplace different, I always like to do it when it's clear out, because then you could really see the geography of the area and what's happening there. When I'm around here, I'll just do it just because, you know, you look up in the sky and it's like, you know, there's a cloud over there. And then you get the satellite image back and it looks like, oh, no, that cloud was in Illinois. You know, it looked like it was right over us. So it gives you a really interesting perspective.
So are we helping then with the weather people or weather?
Yeah. So the one of the things that one of my research is to from these satellites is to determine whether or not you know, a particular view has got cloud cover or not, and so validating that, we have a variety of ways of doing that. In this way, we're going to use this app to have people actually doing it, so that we have validation of a variety of geographic regions. A variety of good people making these observations. We're just opening up the web page now, so you can see what other people were doing as well.
And how do we get involved?
So the best way to get involved, unfortunately, currently it's just for the iPhones or iPads that have cameras. But we'll be doing an Android once we get it to the way we like it. At least Liam and Dave Parker promised that. if you have an iPhone or an iPad, go to the App Store and search on SatCam, SATCAM, for a satellite camera. And you'll be able to download it. It's free. And you'll be able to collect images and share them with your friends. And eventually we'll going to allow rating of other people's photos as well.
Oh,
so it's really interesting to see. And, you know, the map of it is all over the world, you know, so people from South Africa, from Australia, from France, you know, so you get to see all these pictures from all over the place. It's pretty cool.
That's neat.
I love that idea.
It's a great idea.
It's a great idea. And apparently Liam came up with it at a meeting when he was sitting there next to people, and people were saying, boy, it'd be great to get this data right, you know, right to people. Why do you have to go on the web? Why can't I see it right now? I mean, I have a phone. And so he said, yeah, we should be able to do that.
Yeah.
So he put together a team and boom.
One of those things that sometimes happens after hours, you're having a beer and it gets, you know.
Yeah, right.
Drawn up on a napkin.
It's the real important aspect of meeting face-to-face. You know, we're doing a lot of virtual meetings now. And there's advantages and disadvantages of that. I mean, the advantage is that they're often less expensive, particularly if you're far away. But that face-to-face, you just can't. I mean, that's how we've learned to communicate, and
that's
really
that's
important to get together, because really good ideas come out of just people just talking and then drawing on a mat napkin, right?
And if you put them in the context of how much the investment of that extra money to get them together costs over the long haul, it's nothing.
It's nothing, right.
It's also free.
Yeah, and it also shows you that we don't go out to eat at really fancy places.
Yeah.
Because they'd be cloth napkins and we couldn't take them home.
That's right.
The paper napkins.
That's a good point. That's a really good point.
Oh, man. Our weather guy's with us today, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW. Great to have them along. Thank you for listening in. Questions? For them, as we talk weather and climate, how's the summer been for you? Has it felt normal or unusual so far? Have you witnessed any interesting weather phenomena lately? We'd love to hear about it. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a photo or question on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. And Chris in Milwaukee has a question, so let's go to Chris. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, sometimes, pardon me, most of the time when I'm looking at the sky in the summer, I see clouds and I see lots of detail and I can see the edges of clouds and I see interesting, you know, fractal-like structures. Once in a while, perhaps five times each summer, I look up and I see the same structures, but everything looks like a slightly out-of-focus photograph. Have the two guests noticed the same thing? It really is remarkably consistent from horizon to horizon, and it looks like the background of a cheap hologram, if you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are all different cloud types, different heights, so not just the high clouds.
Well, how do I explain this? All I can tell you is most days when I look at clouds, they have a certain appearance that is crisp and distinct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then once in a while, the entire sky has a blurriness to it that's remarkably poetic and beautiful, but I don't understand what causes that.
Yeah.
Is this water vapor? And I can tell, by the way, it looks remarkably like a photograph that's out of, in which the plane of focus is set wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think what you're seeing, it's really a great observation, and it's a key to why clouds precipitate, as it turns out. That you, especially in the summer, I think in the fall, you see this a little more obviously. Like this last few days have been great examples of this. When the clouds have that cauliflower-looking, real sharpness to them, they're composed of water droplets, liquid water droplets, which evaporate readily in the air that's outside the cloud that's subsaturated. Then they glaciate. We don't really know how this happens yet. It's a mystery, but it's a very important one, how the ice actually forms in clouds. So the water goes from being only in the liquid state to being also in the ice state. And ice is a lot more resistant to sublimation in unsaturated air than what liquid water is to evaporation in subsaturated air. So it gives that fuzzy look to it. And you can, if you see an isolated cumulus cloud on your lunch break, and you see it go from that really sharp, defined cauliflower look to it to that fibrous look to it at the top, especially it'll happen at the top first, then you can watch a rain shaft come out the bottom of that thing all within 1 hour. So that's what's probably causing the blurry nature of what you're describing, is that you've finally, the water substance has gone from vapor to liquid first and then from liquid to ice, and the ice really puts a gauzy look to the clouds.
Yeah.
By the way, oddly, one day I noticed the distinct detail, the fractal-like structure, you know, tiny tendrils, and that too was out of focus.
Mm.
In other words, when I see the sky that looks remarkably consistently out of focus, if you will, I have seen that while the clouds have that particular unfuzzy look to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a contradiction, but I've actually noticed that. And to explain that is beyond me, which is why I called in.
Yeah. My guess is it's the mixture of liquid and ice for the water substance that makes that collage of the beauty that you're talking about. It's really neat.
So you get a gradient in the number of particles and some volume,
exactly.
In the water clouds, that gradient occurs really fast, so it looks very distinct.
Exactly.
And with ice,
right.
It kind of
gets a little
smooths
fuzzier.
Out. Yeah, and it gets fuzzier, right? Like you said. Yeah. Does that make sense?
I guess. By the way, in 1973 or 1974, I saw the Skylab space station pass overhead outdoors.
Yeah, I did two once, yeah.
And now I've been watching the International Space Station come by, and it, just to my own subjective eye and brain system, it appears larger, which it is. But I suspect that the sky is messier and has more junk in it. But
you can see a lot more satellites now than you did back in 73, 74. Mm. So yeah, I'm assuming you're seeing them at night, right? You see the little dots in the sky.
Yeah, I'm getting at is it seems the sky was clearer in 1973 as compared to today. But I can't quantify that.
Huh, that would be an interesting thing to look at. So the Clean Air Act started in 72, right?
Yeah, early 70s,
Yeah. So I would have expected it to go the other way. But again, a lot of it is light pollution, too, so the cities could be growing up and things like that.
That's true.
Thanks, Chris, for calling. Appreciate your call. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, our weather guys, our guests. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at weather and climate today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Great to have you listening in. Questions? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question and or photo on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we have some great photos coming in. Here's a couple from Kathy from Pine Lake in Hillas or Hiles. That's a light show and a really interesting cloud. Looks like, is it rain coming out of that cloud? Or
it, like it is.
Yeah, it is. Given the time of year, we were just talking about that. A lot of times you see the rain shaft coming out of a cloud, and a lot of times it's darker than the cloud around it. But this is, John and I was just saying that it must be illuminated by the sun because it looks very bright, and she said it's raining. So
I think she's looking south, and the sun's going to the bottom half of the sky in the west or something. Yeah.
It's really pretty.
It's a gorgeous picture.
Really pretty. Christine in Iron River has a question. Hi, Christine.
Good morning.
Morning.
First of all, I'm in beautiful northern Wisconsin, and I'll just make a comment that my lake is still down, coming up. My question is, though, earlier this year, these nice guys had forecast a cooler, wetter spring until July 1st, and my friends were so impressed that I was right on telling them this. So I'm wondering what we're looking at for fall.
I'm just going to correct and just say that John forecast.
Well, he did a great job.
Well, he did, okay.
I don't even remember doing that. And I was going to advise you to never take our advice on such things, Christine.
Well, I planted accordingly.
That's great. I'm glad it worked out. I don't really know what to expect coming in the fall. I think, though, that one of the things that tends to be the case when it's wet in the summertime is that it is hard to get really hot. You know, the last year we had just the opposite, that feedback between a lack of precipitation, the ground heats up easier when it's dry and so on. I think that we're probably not going to see a really hot, dry fall. That doesn't mean that I know, anywhere else in that whole phase space what might be the case, but I bet you that's the one that's least likely.
Yeah. So the solar energy is going in to evaporate the water and dry things out, not to warm them.
Exactly right.
So we're looking at an early winter with lots of moisture, or?
I don't think John's going to go that far.
I won't go that far, but that's a good question. I wonder how that all works. I'm going to suggest that the fall will be closer to normal than it will be to warmer than normal or colder than normal. That'll be my guess.
Yeah.
And I think part of that stage has been set by the rain we've had both in the spring and the summertime. What happens after that tends to start to get governed by more remote processes. Things that are going on in the tropical oceans is one aspect of the remote control. So it's harder to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not too definitive, but I'll take it.
No. And Christine, I bring you back again to my warning that I started the whole conversation with. Don't take too much of it without a giant chunk of salt.
It's just been so nice to be in the know this spring.
I'm glad it worked out. Thanks, Christine.
Call back in August, and John will give a better answer.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join it, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Our weather guys will be with us right up until 12:30 today, which is great. Just to note that one today, John Munson will be talking, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, and it's this week's edition of All Things Political at 1 o'clock. But right now, weather and climate on our minds, and James in Oconomowoc, your turn. Hi, James.
Hey, hi, guys. Great show. I've been wanting to ask a meteorologist this question for some time. When we talk about greenhouse gases, and I'm trying to visualize literally how far up off the surface of the Earth is that area? Like, what's the top part of that? Is it 7 miles up? Or I'm looking out at in Oconomowoc today. We have a lot of clouds. They have sort of like flat bottoms to them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to, because we talk about it all the time, and I think people like say, look at smokestacks and think about like car emissions and stuff as if it's just going up in outer space, and I don't think that's the case, but I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah, no, that's a good insight. You're right. There's a couple of different answers to this question. Where we live in the atmosphere is known as the troposphere. And at our latitudes, it's the top of the troposphere is about 10, 12 kilometers. So somewhere on the order of 6 to 7, maybe 8 miles high. In the summertime, a little bit higher. In the wintertime, a little bit lower. That is a pretty effective cap on things like pollution emitted from smokestacks and various other things that we might put into the atmosphere. It doesn't easily get mixed into the next higher level known as the stratosphere, although it does get mixed into the stratosphere fairly vigorously, but just not as well as you can mix the air up in the troposphere. But if you were to fill up a bag full of air at the ground and then climbed an enormously high ladder and kept climbing to higher and higher heights, not till you get to about 50 miles above the surface of the planet will you stop having the same ratio of chemical constituents in each bag that you fill up. So that 50-mile deep layer is known as the homosphere. Everything's mixed about the same in that layer. After that, it starts to settle out by atomic weights. So that's why there's a couple of different answers to your question. One could say all the way up to 50 miles above the ground, you have to think about that as one chunk of the atmosphere. In other contexts, going up about 6 or 7 miles is about enough.
Hmm. Yeah, and so, go ahead, sorry.
Well, I heard somebody, and I don't know who it was a climate scientist somewhere, and he had this concept of if you could, squish out all the moisture in the atmosphere and the densest part of our atmosphere, it would fill a pool of about 30 feet deep. I don't know if that makes sense. Does that?
If you took a column and squeezed it all out, I'm guessing your thickness would be like 4 centimeters,
yeah,
5
right.
centimeters.
It's known as precipitable water, right? You're thinking about
right, yeah. Yeah, so like that's like 2 inches.
Right.
Yeah. Now, maybe if you took it over the entire globe.
Then it's two inches on top of the whole surface area of the globe is an enormous amount of water.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Wow, okay.
But per column, it's probably 2 inches.
When we're looking out at these flat clouds like we have today, you know, the kind of flat bottom clouds in Oconomowoc, is that about 7 miles up? What causes the flatness? And I think that's like my last question. I was just curious.
So
I'm trying to visualize
this
like little like area, which really is a lot of stuff's moving around, right?
Yeah. So I'll say two things. One is that clouds generally form as air rises, and then they reach a saturation where the relative humidity is about 100%, and then boom, condensation occurs. And so where you're seeing that flatness, that's where the condensation, what we call the condensation level, the lifted condensation level, and that's why they're so flat, is because it's at that altitude where the vapor will condense out into form a cloud.
Yeah, and it tends to be locally, very, very,
very variable,
very variable from one spot to the other. But if you're looking at your own sky, it's going to be pretty
uniform
in that area.
Yeah, and the atmosphere isn't that thick in terms of where the weather. 6 miles. I mean, get in your car and drive 6 miles. That's not that far. Yeah.
Well, so that's what okay, and this is like my last thought is that's what I wish meteorologists would do more of in terms of like we're talking about the new normal, climate change. No matter where you are politically on that, band is very real, and I think. It would really be helpful if we could visualize how really close to Earth that really is.
Here's how one way you can visualize it. Cut an apple in half. Look at the thickness of the skin relative to the fruit. That skin is 72 times thicker relative to the fruit than the atmosphere is to the Earth's surface.
Yeah. Whoa.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Wow.
Isn't that astounding?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Thank you, Larry. Thanks for answering it, guys. Really cool program.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And that's a really good image that you...
Yeah, I use that a lot. It's actually 32. I said 72. It's 32 times as thin the atmosphere is.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, you don't want to screw around with it.
No, you don't.
There isn't that much of it to screw around.
I peel an apple now. I'm going to think of that. Jeez.
Alex in Salem, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I've been really obsessed with weather ever since the tornado 20 yards from my house. I know it's kind of weird, but and I've checked the weather all the time, and I look at the forecast. And lately, I've seen a pattern where storms are—they might be in their prime and they have a hail core and they're heading towards my house. And then within 5 or 10 miles, right before that, they die and are just a little cluster of rain. And then they might strengthen up after my house. And okay, that's weird.
That is weird.
Yeah. So I was wondering if it's like the lake or something else.
It's hard to say, Alex. I'll jump in first. First of all, excellent set of observations. That's what you got to do. You got to observe these things, tally them, and be honest about your observations. You know, you don't want to be biased towards saying every time a storm comes near me, it disappears or it disintegrates. But you're not. You're telling the honest truth. These storms have life cycles in the summertime of about an hour. And you might intercept these things just purely by accident at the end of their life cycles a little more frequently this summer than you have in prior ones. That might be part of the answer. The lake itself may have something to do with it, although I think I would render the guess that that's probably not the big factor. I'd say that's probably not it. It might just be bad luck, because it sounds to me like you're the kind of guy who wants to see some exciting weather.
Yeah.
And I think that would back up what John just said there. You know, keep making those observations and write them down. Could make a good science project down the road. But I was also thinking this weekend there was a rainstorm coming towards Madison, and on a weather listserv that I'm on, somebody posted, you know, put up the deflector shields.
Oh, yeah.
Because and you could watch this storm come, and it just split right around Madison. Yeah. And I really wanted rain. And so I think that's the other part that influences me anyway, is that when you really want it, somehow the system dies out. Yeah. Or, you know, it develops to the south and you miss it. And when I don't want it, boom, down it comes.
And Alex, let me just say this too. This is exactly the kind of thing that can set you on the path for life. Yeah. All right, I want to tell you why. When I was a little kid, I was growing up in Massachusetts, and I loved snowstorms. And I decided when I was a kid, I want to learn as much as I can about these things, and I'll take as long as it takes in school to do it. And I still am learning about them today, and I'm almost 50. And it's not less fun now than it was when I was 10 or 12 or 15, however old you might be. So keep doing this.
Why do the storms strengthen maybe after my house, and they're strong before my house? Is that just kind of a freak phenomenon?
That's a great question. I can't tell you that I know the answer to that. It could very well be just, again, a string of bad luck for you. But, you know, maybe next summer you're going to see just the opposite. On the other hand, there may just be something we don't understand yet about the way these storms move across your part of the state that we will learn in the future. And we'll say, son of a gun, he was right. There is a tendency for these things to redevelop to his east. That might just be right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I think that explained a lot for me.
All right. Thanks, nice. Alex. Appreciate that call. How old are you, by the way?
12
Excellent. Years old. Excellent. Thank you very much for calling. Call anytime. You can call anytime, Alex. We appreciate having you visit with us. And Dean in Hales Corners, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is sort of a related question. When the tornado season comes or the hurricane season comes, all the meteorologists on television do a very nice job of trying to explain why these things develop, how they develop in terms of physics and math and all that stuff. But I have a hard time understanding. I haven't been able to figure out what makes a tornado actually stop rotating. What's the physics behind it? Is it pressure? Is it temperature change? What's the theory?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would take it from, you know, when these storms develop and they're trying to explain what's happening. The storms are developing because there's what I would think of as an energy imbalance. There's a deficit someplace and more someplace else. And so when the storm develops, there's energetics that are going on that's transporting energy and moisture to different regions of the atmosphere. And then as the system begins to die, that transportation is coming to an end. And so the whole thing is just dissipating. It's kind of like, I don't want to say we've hit an equilibrium, but we've hit a condition where the atmosphere is much more stable, and that just kind of dissipates it out.
It's a really good question.
I wonder if there's a way, if there was, I'm sure it'd be done already, but if we could figure out, you know, how to stop the thing, maybe we could stop it before it hurts some people.
Yeah,
I think that that would be, certainly a laudable goal. But these things are, first of all, you'd have to be deployed at exactly the right spot. That would require a prediction of pinpoint accuracy. And then you'd have to have a scheme, and we don't know what that might be right now, and you're pointing this out. You'd have to have a scheme by which you could kind of interfere with some of those ingredients. But that's a really tricky problem, and it requires, I think the biggest part of it is it requires a pinpoint accurate forecast, both in time and space. In addition to a reasonable procedure once you've made that forecast. Really hard to do. But I think I like Steve's description of it, that, you know, these any kind of storm, small scale like a tornado or big scale like a mid-latitude storm, they develop as a consequence of an accumulation of slight imbalances of one kind or another. And then once they get going, they start to change the environment in such a way that those imbalances can actually be reduced. And unfortunately, that often means that the storms themselves disappear. There's not a single storm we know of except the Great Red Spot that's lasted hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. And even if we,
for your kindness.
Yeah,
and even if we could pinpoint it, it would still take a lot of energy,
to kind of keep
it from developing.
So, staying on storms for a minute here, we had an email from Pete in Edgerton, and he's last Monday night there was an incredible lightning show. In the western sky, as seen in Edgerton, which is east of Madison. Rather than lightning strikes, the sky was continually lighted with bursts of light for over an hour. He'd never seen anything like this, wondering the cause.
That was some storm.
That was awesome.
That was fun.
It was to the southwest from where we were, Madison. It was just phenomenal to watch.
I was golfing. It was my golf night, and we were at the Middleton Pleasant View Golf Course, which is up on the highest hill in the area. And of course, we were chased off the course and sat in the restaurant bar area and just watching this lightning show from way up high.
It was
really something.
It happens about once a summer, it seems to me. Last summer, my son won the state 16-17-year-old Little League championship. And the night that we won the game, we had to drive back home down 151, I think from northeast of Beaver Dam. And it was right along, it was a squall line just to the northwest of the highway. And we saw the lightning all the way home. And it didn't start raining until we got right down to State Street, which was unbelievable.
And it was
a great show.
And so back to his question, I guess. There are different types of lightning. And ones that I think we mostly get admired by, where you see that big bolt, is ones that are going from the cloud down to the ground.
Yeah.
And that's because it's clear air, so you can actually see it. But there's a lot of lightning that goes between clouds and within a cloud. And I think a lot of that is what we were seeing. Because most of the lightning in a storm system is in the cloud. It's not from the cloud to the ground.
And there was a lot of that.
And even the ones that I saw, I was on a review panel of an institute and went. And one of the things they do is lightning. And so they have this new thing in the D.C. area where they can get three-dimensional structure of the lightning bolts within a storm.
It's
absolutely fantastic. And one thing that they were able to do was to take a photo of the lightning bolt that comes down out of the cloud base and hits the ground and then match it up with the instrumentation that shows you all the lightning bolts within the cloud. And this little bolt that you see coming out of the cloud of the base traveled like 50 miles within the storm.
Just bouncing around in the cloud before it came out.
Wow. I mean, it's just phenomenal what's going on in these storms and what we're learning.
Can they start to measure then the ratio of in cloud to cloud to
ground? Yeah. And I think the cloud to ground is like 10% of the lightning that occurs. So it's unbelievable.
That's neat.
And what's I'm trying to figure out now is because in a lot of our intro books, when we explain lightning, right, we talk about, you know, the charges gathering at the cloud base that then push it down at the ground, and then you go from the base to the cloud. Well, no, that's not the way it's working.
One out of 10 times.
It's working some other way.
Wayne in Rockland has a question. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. The other day I seen a cloud, and it looked like it was a whole bunch of balls, like round balls. They were nice and smooth all across the bottom of the cloud.
That's a mammatus cloud, and it gets its name from the fact that it looks like the udder of a cow. The Latin word mamma comes in there, and we don't really know exactly how they're formed. There's kind of a dispute about that. Some people think there's downward vertical motion that kind of brings these pendants of clouds down, but that's a hard explanation to really take in, because as the air sinks, it warms up and usually dries out. So I'm not sure that we understand exactly how the mammatus forms, but it's one of the more dramatic cloud types. Tends to be attached to the potential or maybe even an actual working severe storm. Was that the case for you?
Yeah, okay. There was a storm coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this was like at the beginning of the storm or whatever, yeah. The clouds are really round, and it was like they were almost smooth, like somebody sculpted them round.
Yeah, they're awesome, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're beautiful clouds.
Thank you for calling, Wayne. Appreciate it. And yeah, I saw them. I remember being in northern Wisconsin, driving to our cabin in north of Hayward, and those clouds came through, and they looked to be maybe 100 yards above the road.
Oh,
I mean,
man.
They were really low.
I've never
low.
Seen them that low. Right, yeah.
They were
that would
really,
be scary.
Really low. It was really
wow.
scary.
Wow. I think the best time to catch them is when they're illuminated by the setting sun,
yeah.
because you can
yeah.
see all sorts of definition of that geometry that you're talking about.
Yeah, and that could change them yellow and orange
yeah,
things, too.
It's just really, awesome.
Yeah.
We have next Neil in Cameron. Thank you, Neil, for calling. Hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good.
Good. Hey, well, I kind of understand the principle of my question here as far as contrails. I'm a professional pilot, and we're up in the mid to upper 30s, 38,000, 39,000. A lot of times I'll be following a jet, and he'll develop a contrail for a short period of time, 15 to 30 seconds, and then it will stop. Mm. And I know that this is not a conspiracy theory because I pre-flight my airplane pretty well. I know there's no nozzle sticking out of it. But, and I understand it's condensation, it's a moisture thing, but how much of a change in temperature, because I don't see any change in, like, airspeed or saturated air temperature on the flight management system, so apparently it's a very small temperature change that will yeah. make a contrail or not make a contrail.
Or a humidity change.
Yeah, it's
okay.
I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say it's very much. Yeah, I mean it's kind of like the atmosphere can be really unsaturated. Well, obviously because there isn't a cloud forming there when you can see the contrail.
Right.
But when the exhaust air comes out of the jet, that mixing of the air around it, if it's the conditions are just right, is when the contrail. Will form, and it's much like the breath. When you breathe out on a winter day, some days you can really see your breath, and other days you can't because that mixture, which is a nonlinear mixture, just isn't quite
humidity.
Right. Yeah,
and it's true that you can have really small scale variations in humidity that I think most aircraft sensors, even on research equipped aircraft. The variable that you don't trust so much in flight at the time, you got to have it calibrated afterwards, is the relative humidity. That, and especially, we're talking about tenths of a percent of change of relative humidity can be enough to suddenly form some of these ice crystals versus times where you won't on the flight path. So it's extremely sensitive to the relative humidity of the air.
Oh, that's interesting because that's what I was wondering. How close? Because our throttle settings stay consistent. As we're in cruise, we usually don't vary that unless there's some sort of atmospheric change significant enough that would warrant an airspeed change.
Yeah.
But and we've always joked about that. I'm sitting there with a co-pilot, and it's like, well, should we make a 360 and see if we're making a trail or not?
When you cross them, do you feel any turbulence? Are you big enough that it doesn't really matter? Or?
Actually, I fly a business jet, and the turbulence, from what I can tell after 20 years of flying, is completely non-related to the contrail.
Yeah.
There seems to be no correlation that I can really tell.
Yeah.
And it's just really strange. I mean, I've seen jets. I've been following jets, maybe, they'd be 2,000 feet below me going the same direction. And, they'll make a contrail for a very short period of time. I say 10, 15 seconds, of course they're doing 8 miles a minute, but, so it's a little bit of a time, a little bit of a distance that would do this, but then they'll just go off for a little bit and then it'll start back up again. And, and it's like, man, that's got to be a really, like you said, and that's what I was wondering with the very small relative humidity change. It has to be very, very small, apparently, to make that change. And that's kind of what I was wondering.
Yeah, I bet that's it. If I had to put money on it, I'd put it on the relative humidity change, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool. Well, thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Neil, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. We have open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly here as we talk with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the University of Wisconsin Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org with your questions and send a photo and or question to my Facebook page as well at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Judith Sears Poisson answering the phones today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at weather and climate today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Thank you for listening in. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org or post a photo or a question on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Email from Gary in Wausau. Is it true that the warmer weather in Greenland causes the jet stream to dip, causing cooler weather here? Isn't this the coolest spring and summer in quite a few years?
I don't know about the connection between a warmer Greenland. That means for this season.
Yeah.
And where the jet is over North America. I'm a little skeptical about that, but that could be just my own ignorance. I'm willing to admit that's possible.
Or your own expertise, I should
yeah,
say, too.
Yeah. Right, or the other side of the coin. I think that those kind of connections are very worthy of investigation, but I don't think the jury's in yet on whether or not they're really accurate. I can say that just this morning before I came over, though, I'm looking at the last 65 winters, snowy versus not snowy, based on a snow-covered data set.
Yeah.
And when it's warm over Greenland and the Labrador Sea, anomalously warm in the wintertime, it tends to be snowier over the land masses of the Northern Hemisphere. That's weird.
Oh.
I don't really understand why yet, but it tends to be true.
So would you think of the pattern of the storms? I mean,
it could
we think
that,
it'd be a
yeah.
ridge over there,
it
for
sets
example,
things up for, I think, maybe what you do is you end up getting Spain, Portugal, parts of France involved in getting snow cover in such winters because the jet in the Atlantic's weaker and further south. But that has something to do with what's going on over Greenland. Whether that happens in a similar way or in an unsimilar way in the summertime, I don't know.
Hmm. Very interesting. We have an email from Bill in Madison. When the National Weather Service radio gives us rainfall for the year in its daily reports, is it including the liquid equivalent of water that is melted snow? Is it adding melted snow from the early part of the year to the rainfall amounts?
Usually they do that.
I would
yeah.
think so.
If they give you the annual total, that's exactly
right.
what it is.
Yeah.
Melted equivalent when it's frozen and liquid equivalent. Or just liquid when it's not.
It's liquid equivalent when it's liquid.
Yeah, that's an easy equivalent. It's 1-to-1.
A lot easier to measure.
John and Madison, it's your turn. Thanks, John, for calling.
Yes, thank you. Sometimes when a storm is approaching, let's say in the summer, it looks like it's definitely going to rain, and it's very dark, and there is one big strike of lightning, and then starts raining. Is it triggering something? Is it coalescing the water droplets? Is the lightning precipitating the rain?
The lightning isn't precipitating the rain. So what happens is when the lightning is forming, or in these convective storms, these thunderstorms, what you have is a strong vertical updraft, and as liquid particles hit with ice particles, you have exchanges of charges, and that eventually leads to the lightning. It's also that updraft that's forming the rain. And so you'll get both the lightning and the rain. And what I'm wondering is, and I don't know if I've seen any studies about this, is does it rain first or does it lightning first or does it? So the lightning wouldn't cause the rain, but I'm wondering if you could have lightning. You certainly could have lightning before the rain starts. There's no doubt about that.
The elevated thunderstorms in the Canadian West are like that. There are fire risk as a result.
Oh,
they
that's
don't
right.
really
yeah.
precipitate much, but they have a lot of
lightning.
Yeah.
So the lightning doesn't, but the cause of both the lightning and the rain are coupled together. The same thing.
Hey, well, another question that hits me right now is in a major. Well, I don't know how big of a storm it would be, but that blows through in maybe let's say an hour. What is the weight of the rain or the water in the clouds in a particular big thunderstorm at that time?
That's a pretty
what an excellent question. I don't know the answer. I can tell you this though. I know this, so maybe we can kind of divide it and try and figure it out. At any one moment in the Earth's atmosphere, the whole atmosphere, northern, southern hemisphere, everywhere in the whole atmosphere, there is 6 million billion tons of water vapor in the atmosphere. That's not even including the ice in the clouds and the liquid water droplets. So there's 6 million billion tons of water in the atmosphere at any one time. Those clouds, they must have hundreds of metric tons of water in them, I would think.
Yeah.
I would think that's probably even a ridiculously conservative estimate.
You know, I can't think of it now. I just did this calculation about a year ago for fog.
Oh, did
how it? Much water was in fog?
Oh,
and it
that's
was,
right.
And yeah. It was a huge amount.
Yeah, that's right.
And the same thing for, like, if it rains, you know, like 2 inches on Dane County. Didn't you do that calculation
once? I did it
for
snow, but I turned it into energy.
Oh, it turned into energy.
I wanted to know how much energy it was.
Yeah.
And it, one of the intermediate steps is how much water is actually involved, the mass of water, and I don't have that in my memory.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great question, but I'll bet it's tons and tons. Hundreds, maybe thousands of tons of water, maybe much more than that even.
Yeah, I would bet, since you're from Madison, I would say it's Mendota and Monona put together.
Yeah, maybe it is.
Well,
yeah.
Just put into tiny little droplets.
Yeah.
And just think of how much energy it takes to get that kind of water up in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
That's just
amazing.
Huge amount of energy in these storms.
And to change its phase. That's the exciting
change
thing
it, right,
for me.
Yeah,
from my perspective on this other thing, it was the change of phase. It really got me excited.
There you go, John. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Great photo from my good friend Kurt Westbrook. As we were talking about clouds earlier, and you know, a cloud appearing to be out of focus.
Yeah, that's it.
Kurt's got one here of a cloud in focus,
and then
one that looks like it's out of focus in the same picture.
Yeah,
that's actually really phenomenal. And actually, it also makes me think the one that's out of focus kind of looks like a snake or a worm.
Looks like it's lenticularis, actually. And they tend to be kind of fuzzy like that because they're formed maybe a little bit more in situ, and so the water can change to ice while it's sitting there. But the other one's just a fair-weather cumulus cloud that might have just very local origin and hasn't glaciated yet. So that's interesting. It would be really cool to know what's going on there. Does it say where this was taken? I'm kind of far away.
My guess is somewhere in the Madison area, probably near, could have been near Arlington, somewhere around there.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah,
it is a clear
example. It was taken on June 4th. So
that is a very clear example of the non-clarity of some clouds.
Yeah, really perfect example.
Yeah,
and then Jill sent us a really cool photo. I was surprised to see rays coming up from the eastern horizon at sunset last week. We had a big storm closing in from the west, so I wasn't sure if it was somehow reflecting the sunset. Or could have been the moon rising. It was about a half hour before the official moonrise.
So those are crepuscular rays. And actually, they're caused by clouds, but the clouds are not causing the bright stuff. The clouds are actually causing the dark streaks, which are actually shadows. So if the cloud wasn't there, the lightness in the sky that you're seeing in that photo is what the sky would normally look like. But when you have a cloud in there, it kind of, that's a cloud shadow. You can think of it that way. And that's what causes the darker streaks.
Well, she turned around and faced west. And there's the photo from what it looked like
that
in the west.
That was good thinking. That was really good thinking. So that points out, I think, a couple of those streaks. You can almost pinpoint the clouds in the top picture that might have, you know, the shadowing effect on the sky.
Yeah.
That's a really
and that's
really
pretty
cool.
By itself because they're it totally is. Different colors.
Yeah.
One is purplish and one is yellow.
Yeah, really interesting to look at. Let's see here. Whoops. Thought I had one more here. Gary wonders what these are really interesting columnar kinds of clouds. I saw in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin about a month ago. And so it's like trails almost of clouds.
Yeah, you know what that looks like? I mean, these are really weird-looking clouds.
Yeah, they
but
are.
What it, really weird.
Yeah, so there it's a it looks like an altocumulus because you can still see the sun through it.
Oh,
and
yeah, yeah. I know what you're gonna say.
And so what I'm thinking is happening is altocumulus are water clouds, but they're probably super cool.
Yeah.
And then we were talking about the super cooled becoming ice and the cloud becoming glaciated. And so then you've seen these rib structures that are kind of like clear air with another thin cloud in between. Yeah. And I'll bet that those areas have glaciated.
They got glaciated and the ice
generated the ice and the ice has fallen out.
You can see this sometimes more isolated than this. This is a series of them. Looks like strips of bacon on a frying pan. But you can see them more isolated through this altocumulus or stratocumulus that's super cool. And an airplane goes through.
Right,
because the propellant stuff, this very stuff we're talking about in contrails, ice particles seed those clouds, and you get these big holes in the cloud. This would have had been a formation of planes.
Yeah, right.
a really tight formation. Boy,
I wouldn't have been in one of them because they're pretty close.
That's really interesting. Yeah. But I bet that's the mechanism. Very interesting how that happened, how that seeding started, and why it's alternating is a very interesting question.
Yeah.
Mary in Port Washington, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love this topic. I've been a big fan of severe weather since I was a little kid in my
brother was studying for climatology, and he'd come home and tell us things to watch for severe weather. And one of the questions I think I've never asked him or looked up was, how did the term squall line get its name? Is that navigational or...
All right, so how do we get the term?
I'll take the line part and leave the other one for John.
Yeah.
So the line, I mean, they form in a line. The thunderstorms develop in a line, and that's where you get the line part. Where
the
squall
comes. Squall is a maritime word. I think that comes from the long encounters among mariners and severe weather. And I think that probably they realized that there are certain squalls, such as what they end up calling hurricanes, were not line storms. They were sort of bigger area than that. And then there were other squalls that were on a line. And I think that might be where it came from.
So is it associated with wind? Is where that squall?
Yeah, right. And you could see a thunderstorm coming. I'm not a mariner myself, but I know I've heard people say when they're out on Lake Michigan or out in the Atlantic Ocean, they see a thunderstorm complex in a line coming off the shore. They know it's going to be squally. That's the word. If it's linear, they know they just got to navigate through one little spot of it. If it's not linear, that's a lot scarier because you can't get away.
Our guests today, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, will be with us right up until 12:30. I hope you'll join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Post a question or comment there. We'll be back after the news. Weather is fascinating, isn't it? Maybe it's because it's one thing we've not figured out how to control, or maybe it's just because it can produce some great beauty. Also, some pretty terrible devastation, too. Larry Mueller here. I know I appreciate our monthly visit with the UW Weather Guys, and I'm betting you do, too. They help us understand what we're experiencing and to know what might be in store for us. John Martin, professor and chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, one of our guests. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for coming by. And Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Great to see you again, Steve.
Great to be here again.
Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too. All of our lines are filled right now, but here's the number, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. And we've got... on our Facebook page, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page if you haven't been there yet, because there are some outstanding photos, weather-related photos, including this one from Sven, I believe.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting cloud.
Yeah, that is a really... It looks like he's taken, or she, he's taken the cloud, the picture upward, looking straight up, and those are branches, because it's the variation and the brightness of that
it's
cloud
very
is very it's really not uniform. It's very
very interesting.
Yeah,
and here's another shot from that person as well. That it almost looks like a fan, or the cloud almost looks like a
Look like an anvil. I would
that
think
looks like a big cumulus cloud hitting the tropopause. Yeah, that's a big anvil.
So you're getting the spreading out of the
It's
gorgeous.
Cloud.
And then Marcus sent us some pictures of clouds on top of clouds.
Yeah, that looks like your classic. If you just show me the picture of that cloud, I would have called it like a lenticulous cloud, which is what you get over mountains. They're saucers, flying saucers stacked up. But it's over a lake, so maybe there's just enough terrain there to generate that.
Or there's an updraft there, and the next layer of air is going up over the hump in the updraft.
That column
of rising air actually... can feel like topography to the layer of air above. But it would have to be really strong. It doesn't seem like that's the answer. But it's probably topography, like you said.
And then Tim sent another interesting photo and wonders if these are contrails.
Yeah, these look like lines of cirrus clouds. Yeah. So they're ice clouds like contrails turn into. But I don't think those are contrails. You do get these patterns of waves and clouds a lot as the air moves up and down, and that's kind of what it looks like.
Yeah, and they're kind of polarized. You know, the waves seem to have crests at perpendicular angle to one another at different elevations, which is interesting. And it points out how three-dimensional the atmosphere is. And so when you see a cloud, if you think that's the whole layer of cloud, there could be several different layers separated by clear layers in between them. And it's quite, when you fly on an airplane, you see that all the time.
Axel in Black River Falls has a cloud-related question. Hi, Axel. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm 66 years old, and I've had a question for decades that's haunted me. It's so simple, but yet I've never been able to understand why that is. If you look at a cumulus cloud, there's a very defined edge where there is cloud and where there is no cloud. Now, my question is why is there the why and what is the difference between the air where there is cloud and where there is no cloud? I've also walked down a mountain pass, walked into a cloud, turned around, taken four steps back, and I'm out of the cloud. So my question is what is the difference, and why doesn't the moisture dissipate all over?
So what happens in the first case, and then I'll let John take the second case, is in that first case, what's forming those clouds always is lifting motion. And in that first case where you get those nice cumulus clouds, that lifting motion is coming from the sun heating up the ground. And then as the ground gets hot, it heats the air next to it, and that air rises. And that rising air is eventually going to hit a condensation, relative humidity hits 100%, and then the cloud forms. Now, the other part that happens is that as that air rises, there needs to be air to replace it. Otherwise, you'd have a vacuum generating. Oh. And so air comes in from the sides to replace that rising air. And then air that's coming in from the sides got to be replaced by something. And that's replaced by sinking air from up above. Mm-hmm. And it's that sinking air that warms and dries the atmosphere and prevents clouds from forming. And so in those cumulus clouds, and this is why a lot of times in planes as you're landing, as you go through a field of cumulus, it gets turbulent, shaky, because in the cumulus clouds, you got the updrafts, and the area around it, you have sinking air. And that makes it very contrast as well in terms of the sharp edges that we were talking about earlier.
And that's a really good explanation. And so underlying that, again, is relative humidity differences. When the air is sinking, it's dried out. Its relative humidity goes way down. And the air in the cloud that's been subjected to ascent, as Steve pointed out, is constantly having its relative humidity sustained at near 100% or driven up towards 100% if it didn't start there. And so when you're walking along a mountain path, it's again going to be relative humidity. And it's you give a great example of how sensitive a region can be to this. You can walk just a few steps into the fog, which is a ground cloud, and then walk back out. And you might not be able to sense it. I don't think any of us can. But there's a fractional decrease in the relative humidity just outside of that spot when you walk back into the so-called clear air. And then it goes up again when you walk into the fog. And if you're careful, even if you're driving on the highways here in the southern part of the state at this time of year when the corn is kind of mature, you can actually see very local fog banks at night in one part of a field even. Maybe they have a finger that goes across the highway. You drive right through it and it's clear again. You won't see fog again the whole way home. But right in that little finger, for reasons that have to do with cooling, maybe the flow of air off of local hills, and you get a little river of relatively colder air, the relative humidity's just high enough to form that fog. And everywhere else, just low enough to prohibit it. It's really interesting.
In the wintertime, when we've probably all done this, we've taken a pot of hot water and it's 35 degrees below zero, and you throw that up in the air. So why would we not see a little cloud form?
You actually do see a little cloud form. It just really dissipates real fast. And there's some great web YouTube photos of people doing that, and you're right. You kind of see it. It almost goes into a cloud and dissipates, and then the ground, all the water, goes away before it hits the ground.
And those few tiny droplets of liquid water that remain in the air and form that little fibrous cloud that you might see for a second. The air that you've thrown it into is so dry that they don't have a chance to survive as liquid water droplets. Yeah. They evaporate almost right away.
I see. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So hopefully we ended your haunting.
Thanks, Axel. And Mai Lin in Galena, Illinois. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, hi, Larry. John, Steve. Some years ago, I lost a cousin to what was called clear sky lightning. And this apparently occurred on a sunny afternoon. I'm not sure whether there were clouds in the area, but that's how it was described to me. And I've been puzzled and looking for some explanation.
Yeah, so it's also called Strikes Out of the Blue, I think.
Yeah, probably right. Yeah. I've heard that. Yeah.
And usually it is that there is storms in the area. And so sometimes, you know, we often think about lightning as occurring within the cloud and right from the cloud base right to the ground. But lightning strokes can come out of the sides of the clouds or out of the tops of the clouds and then find their way down to the ground. Because remember, some of these lightning bolts can be 50 miles long, so they can travel a long way. And so that's probably what you experienced, mm-hmm. is that, yeah, there was clear skies above you, but somewhere in the vicinity there was a storm. And that's why they have the rule of if you hear it roar, go indoors.
Yeah.
If you hear the thunder roar, that you're in danger, even though it's blue above you, and you should go seek shelter.
There you go.
If you see the lightning from a distance, then you're in a danger zone.
Oh, yeah. I'd say definitely. That's a safe thing to conclude also, yeah. I know that at Little League fields, if they hear, as Steve said, you don't even see the storm anywhere near you. Just hear a rumble of thunder and everybody's off the field. And it's really, it can be frustrating, but it's exactly the right thing to do.
Yeah, because you're probably carrying metal bats.
And all sorts of things. Yeah. And as you say, you just can't be sure you're not going to get struck, even when the thing is remote from you. It's just, you don't want to play games with that.
And thanks very much for calling. Just to go along with that, Rod from Waukesha sent an email about lightning. Thought I heard that bolts of lightning start from the ground up instead of downward, or can it go in either direction?
It can go in either direction. Most of them go from cloud to lightning. But also, if you look at the current flow, I think the current flow, the way we define it in physics, goes from the ground up. Mm. It always confuses me, and I always got to go look it up.
Yeah, I don't know much about that stuff. I know there's places. You probably are on this panel. Was it New Mexico State does a lot of lightning research?
Arizona, yeah.
Yeah, they do a lot of lightning research.
Yeah. Back to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, a couple of more really cool photos. Listener Scott shared this photo of ground fog
in a river valley,
taken from 36,000 feet.
Awesome.
So it looks like... Yeah, is it following a river?
It looks like it's following a river, yeah. Yep.
And it looks like there's some sort of a bounded wave structure in there, too, doesn't it?
Yeah, you see that over Lake Michigan a lot, too, when the form forms along the shoreline. You get these waves that travel along it.
Just beautiful.
And you don't really see it from the ground, but when you get above it,
you can see that perspective.
They're really cool.
So there the air is cold, and you have a lot of moisture because you're following the riverbed. So you can reach that saturation real quick.
And here's one.
That's a giant feather.
I know, it's like a downy flake.
Beautiful photo taken of, in Waukesha County. Rebecca took this photo last October while out in the boonies in Waukesha County. Is this an actual cloud or something left by a jet? And it really looks like
a feather. Yeah. It really looks
That looks like a contrail to me. Yeah. That's a beautiful picture, though, and a little segment of one, just like we were talking about earlier, how you don't have to have them be miles long. They can be little segments.
Yeah, so it looks like the stem of the feather would be the original contrail, and then it just spread out.
That's gorgeous.
I think it's a giant bird. It's just
that really
be
cool.
A big bird.
That is awesome.
Daryl and DePier, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I was wondering, what causes a thunderstorm to develop over the same area? I think they call that a train effect.
Oh, yeah. Why do thunderstorms train? Oh, that's a good question. Part of it's that there's, you know, again, we got to appeal to the third dimension in the atmosphere. We tend to think about it just in north, south, east, and west terms, but there's actually a vertical part of it too. And the wind speed and direction changes rather dramatically in certain environments that spawn thunderstorms. The squall line environment is a really good example where you can have really strong changes in the wind direction and speed getting stronger and direction turning more and more to the south and northwest as you go up in many summertime instances. And the southern end of a squall line will have a regeneration of convective thunderstorm cells. So if the thing is moving more or less, if the squall line is not moving very fast to the east, then those newly generated cells on the southern end of the line can kind of move along the line and just keep on hitting roughly the same spot for 6, 7, or 8 hours.
Oh, okay.
And that's really what it is. So you're being visited by, in some instances anyway, that's what it is. You're being visited by new storms that are part of the same collection that was, you know, the original squall line.
Sure. Sure, and I guess that's probably what usually causes flash floods.
Exactly. It's not really the instantaneous intensity of the rain that causes a flash flood. It's the length of time over which it rains at that rate.
Gotcha.
And so getting trained by a number of storms, you really get yourself in trouble with flash floods. Probably what happened in Philly yesterday with their record flood.
Yeah. Okay, and another comment I'd like to make. There's a website, if I can give it, that really has hundreds of weather pictures. They're really beautiful pictures. And if I could give it over the line here.
Sure, yeah.
It's called www.weatherpix.info.
Okay.
And it really has hundreds of really nice pictures.
I've been to that site. It's got some really gorgeous photos by amateurs and professionals. It's impressive.
His name's Jared Smith, I believe it is.
Yeah.
He really did a nice job on that. Yeah. I just wanted to share that.
All right.
Well, thanks, Daryl. That's going to really make my afternoon productive.
Thanks, Daryl, for calling. Appreciate it. Jim in Chippewa Falls, who's a fluid dynamics engineer. We're talking about contrails, condensation trails created by a plane. Jim says they're due to the compression around the jet fuselage and wings. It causes a vortex, and that creates the condensation.
Yeah, so in meteorology, we call those wingtip vortexes. And so they're generally very small and much smaller than what we'll see in the contrail, which is the mixing of the jet engine with the environment. And the only time that I've seen them is on the ground or landing right after a rain. So the air is really close to saturation. The relative humidity is really high. And then that pressure drop as you go across the wings is just enough to cause the air to saturate as it cools down. And you get these little tubes, tiny little tubes come off. But they don't last very long either. They go away pretty quick.
But they can have a pretty good length.
Yeah.
The plane can already be taxiing in, and you can still see these things kind of meandering in the sky, literally 10 to 12 feet above the ground. They're pretty awesome.
Very cool.
So they're two different things.
Two different things. Facebook question from Jody. I found it interesting that this morning our local meteorologist said that it was warmer in Alaska this weekend than it was in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
How unusual is that?
It's pretty unusual for the end of July. But I'd say if you talk about it over the course of the whole year, it's not that unusual over the course of the year. This was a really unusual cold spell for us. I don't think we broke any records, but
I think we hit our, on Saturday, Wisconsin hit its minimum maximum temperature
for
that
the state.
Day.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, that's pretty cool. That's something to be worthy of praise. We did that in Madison on that day too.
Yeah,
but I was hoping for the monthly records.
Oh no, I don't think it was
not
a monthly
quite.
Record.
Okay, but it was pretty cold nonetheless. And this is in the wake of a really intense Arctic storm right near the North Pole, which was further to the east than the state of Alaska. And on the western side of these storms, it tends to be the opposite conditions in the summertime, quite warm and ridgy instead of low pressure and cold. And so it's not surprising to hear that story, although I didn't know it.
I play at a golf tournament in Canada, which I've talked about in the past, in Saskatchewan, the last week of May, usually. And people say, well, isn't that really cold? And I say, normally up there, it's warmer there than it is here.
Yeah.
And people always say, are you sure?
That's where you go.
Is that in western Saskatchewan? I can't remember where you use it. Saskatoon?
It's about 2 hours north of Saskatoon.
Okay.
So about 120 miles north of Saskatoon.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's, it's not halfway up the, at least.
Yeah.
Marshall in Port Edwards, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Question that's bothered me for many, many years. A lightning flash is a split second, a second at the most. And yet I've timed some thunder rumbles that follow as much as 30 seconds. Why does the thunder continue so long when the lightning flash that causes it is only a split second?
That's a good question. And two things come to my mind. One is that once those sound waves get generated, they travel through the atmosphere and they can bend as well and reverberate. So you could be hearing them, as they pass by you, but as they reflect off of nearby buildings. And then the other is that there's multiple bolts going on in a storm. And so when you hear that rumbling, that may actually be coming from a group of lightning bolts that just propagated.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Marshall. Jeff in New Glarus. Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you for calling.
Hello, is it me?
Yes. Go. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm sorry, Jerry. It's your...
Yeah, Jerry. Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was in New Glarus watching that lightning show about a week ago.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so we were watching the lightning go back and forth in the clouds, and then once in a while a bolt would hit the ground, but we weren't hearing anything. Why is that?
The thunder was an accompanying
yeah.
the lightning.
So the thunder is being generated. It's just you're in a silent zone. So as that sound wave propagates, as it hits different temperatures and moistures in the atmospheres, it can bend. And so you can get these silent zones around thunder or lightning bolts. We call that heat lightning. But this is something that they've also experienced during the Civil War. So, you know, as reinforcements would be coming to a battle, because of the temperature structure of the atmosphere, they would hear the sounds of the battle, and then all of a sudden they'd enter this silent zone, and they couldn't hear anything. Mm. So they thought that the battle ended, and so they would stop the double time, and then they would get there, and the battle would be over, and, you know, who they were coming to reinforce lost, and of course they'd be pissed, and they were like, well, we thought it ended.
unbelievable.
So, yeah, it's just the thunders generated. You just can't hear it because the sound wave got propagated to a different region.
And I think that Monday night event, all that convection was to our southeast, at least in Madison. So it was kind of far away anyway, and it's hard for the sound to make it all
make
the way,
it
you know, 50 miles.
Because it gets absorbed every time it hits an object, too.
There you go, Jerry. Thank you for calling. And John in Oshkosh, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. I have a funny story about a rainbow. About a month ago, I was driving on Highway 41 south coming back from Green Bay.
Mm. Yeah.
I got just north of Oshkosh. You could see, it had been raining all day. You could see this tremendous rainbow starting to form, and it just kept growing and growing and growing. I had never seen a rainbow that vivid, and it just got huge. You could see it stretching from one end of Lake Winnebago to the exact opposite end. It was just, you know, huge.
Wow.
And the friend I was driving in the car, I said, oh, my gosh, look at that rainbow. And she said, oh, a rainbow is a rainbow. And I said, no, this thing is huge. I've never seen a rainbow like this before. I get into Oshkosh, and people are actually standing out in the gas station parking lot, pointing up in the sky, taking pictures. I'm like, see, I told you. This thing is huge.
Yeah.
we will support your enthusiasm.
Yeah,
we agree.
So what happened to Cynical Sally after all that?
So then, like a minute later, on the radio, the disc jockey comes on and goes, if you're in the Oshkosh and Fond du Lac area, you got to go outside and check out this rainbow.
That's great. That's great.
You were right. She was right.
It's highly appropriate.
There was one like it in Madison several years back now, but people were stopping. I mean, I stopped my car to get out and look at it. It was the most vivid rainbow I've ever seen. And then it was like a double.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you get the double rainbow.
It too. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, it's hard not to stop. If somebody tips you off to something like that, you're a fool to not take a look because usually people don't say such a thing.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. John, thanks a lot for calling. Oh, Jimmy sent a Facebook note who says, great show with the click and clack of clouds. He said, you can use that, no charge.
That's great alliteration, Jimmy. That's great.
The click and clack of clouds. And unfortunately, the time is up.
Yeah.
But you can at least meet me on August 22nd because the director of the National Weather Service is coming to town to give a talk. He's an UW alumni, and he's going to give a public talk. So if you want to talk to the head fellow who runs the National Weather Service.
Yeah.
August 22nd.
August 22nd at the Wisconsin Institute of Discovery.
He is a very entertaining speaker. It'll be a great presentation.
Very, very knowledgeable. Yeah. A lot of fun.
Thanks, guys. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests, they'll be back, and we'll do this all over again. We'll post that that talk on our Facebook page.
Oh, great, good.
All right.
Larry Mueller Show. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.